conference record has joined the conference.
Okay, well, did you guys all hear that? Conference record has joined the conference. So, again, Wendy and Trish, thank you with all my heart for joining us this evening. And I know by the beeps we've got quite a few on the line. So I'm just going to let you guys go ahead and begin, and I'm going to go on mute so I can pay attention and listen.
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead. Take it away.
Great. Good evening, everybody. It's my pleasure to be with you this evening from my home. If you hear any noise, there's a six-year-old roaming about. I've tried to keep him out, but who knows. So please bear with me. I guess let's begin the discussion. If you have the PowerPoint, we would probably like to look at the PowerPoint and maybe not talk directly to it, but just want to be able to share some thoughts and ideas with you, and then towards the end or maybe the last 15, 20 minutes, hear back from you. So if that's okay, let's talk about culture. And it's such an interesting thing because some people, when in the 15 years that I've been at the National Center for Cultural Competence, I've heard a whole range of understandings and beliefs about culture. And when talking to people, many people say, well, I don't have a culture, or I'm American, and that's all there is to it. But when we look or delve a little bit more deeply, the thing about culture is that everybody has it, and everybody, no matter of their race, their ethnicity, their gender, sexual orientation, geographic locale, probably has more than one over time, has learned and added into their way of being. Lots of things that if you have the PowerPoint, all those things that you see in those bubbles, like your roles and gender roles, roles in your place of work, your role within your family, the languages or language that you speak, how you speak that language, what's expected behavior for you as an adult, as a family member, as a parent, as a caregiver, as a provider, as a fill-in-the-blank. All of those things are aspects of culture. We often think of them about as rituals and courtesies, but often want to assign them to other people. But the important thing about culture is, again, that everybody has multiple cultures, not just the one from their family of origin, but multiple ones. And they actually change over time with your circumstance, with new people that you meet, new experiences that you have, new jobs, or new places of employment that you take on, because all of those locations have or disciplines or jobs or have cultures of their own. And no matter how we try, we're always adding on more layers and actually enhancing ourselves. When we think about culture from a traditional or a group perspective, it really is something that gets handed down from person to person, generation to generation, and definitely is not static. It changes over time. If you look then again at the PowerPoint, want to call your attention to probably the slide that's looking at the onion concept of culture, that whole piece about it being multi-layered, and the fact that if you think of the center of the onion, it's really... think about those people who raised you, your family of origin, your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, the community that you were raised in, where you were raised, if you are native to North Dakota, or if you came from someplace else and are now currently there, all of those different layers, what city in North Dakota, what town, rural, urban, suburban, add on to that, where you got your training, what kinds of jobs, all the different environments that you've been in. And you'll see that all of those different layers and all those influences have come together to sort of make you the cultural being that you are today, now. There are even thoughts about culture, the fact that some people wear their culture differently depending upon, or express their culture differently depending upon where they are. Like maybe at home you are one way in the thick of things, being in your home environment, in your home community, and you may express culture one way there. But in the office, it may not be, or in your place of work, may not quite be the same way. You may not express who you are, who what your cultural background is in the same way. And probably the most important thing is that any behavior, the way you interact, the way family members react or interact with you, that it should always be viewed from that cultural context or through a cultural lens. If we're looking again then at the PowerPoint, probably a really strong concept is really that whole idea of the iceberg, a cultural iceberg concept, which really is talking about the fact that the things that we normally look at to try to figure out who someone is or how we might interact with them is really the stuff often that's on the top, what's above the surface or above the waterline. Maybe we try to figure out their age or their ethnic group or their gender or their who they are based upon what we see, sort of a physical perspective of them. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're way off the mark because who we perceive people to be based upon their appearance or what we consider to be their age or their race or their gender is not always what we see is not always the truth about it. And the fact that actually when you think back to an iceberg theory, that the biggest and most important pieces are below the waterline. They're things that you can't see. So things like decision-making, how people understand justice, concept of justice, what does specific body language or body movements mean, how do they see themselves, how do they see the world outside of them, how do they see people and understand people who are different from them, so that really as we're interacting with families, individuals, communities, probably the key and most critical things that we need to know to help us in working with them is all the stuff that we can't tell by looking at them. And so that causes us to have to add some sort of tools or strategies, some approaches to our toolkit to really help us understand and dig a little bit deeper. So we talked about culture. Let's talk about competence, which is in the slide that you have. A lot of times when we're talking about people, that whole term competence seems somehow to bother them, like, if I'm not competent, then I'm the other end of the spectrum. I'm incompetent. But the idea of competence in this realm is really talking about having some skills to help you to really work as best that you can, to the best of your ability, with people who are different from you, however they may be different. And so when you put the two together and you're talking about cultural competence, you're really talking about an agency and its staff's ability to really work with people from the full range of diverse backgrounds. And in order to do that, the expectation is that there'd be some policy to guide interactions, to guide behaviors, to guide thoughts, to guide actions, to guide how the money is spent, how you plan for making adaptations to service to meet the needs of the diverse populations that you may encounter. So because a lot of times if there's no policy, people sort of, or if there's unspoken policy, then stuff happens depending upon how you interpret it, how I interpret it, how Trish interprets it. May not everybody be working from the same platform. So to have policies that guide us, to have some kind of structures like, for example, maybe a little team or advisory group or something that is thinking about who are the populations that we serve, what are their diverse needs, what are their preferences, are we meeting those preferences, and then how can we plan for helping to bridge any gaps that may be in existence. So it could be a team or a committee, an advisory group, but it also could be having a budget line item that's available, say, for an existence. If you have population that is blind or has problems with vision. I'm thinking like in a lot of cities and a lot of states, there are grandparents who are raising little ones. And sometimes the visual issues or even the hearing issues may not be being addressed by your organization. So do you have a mechanism? Do you have a line item that enables you to be able to do large print just to make it easier to read? Do you have a mechanism for people who may have low literacy to make your written materials understandable to them or at a reading level that might make it easier for them to read and understand and walk away and take that information and do something meaningful? So that's when we're talking about structures. It could be a budget line item. It could be resources. It could be a team of people who are thinking about this issue about cultural competence. When we're talking about practices and behaviors and attitudes, it is that whatever's in your policy around providing care or services and supports to the full range of people, how is it demonstrated? What kind of attitudes do people who maybe if they come to the front desk of your organization or they calling you on the phone for assistance, how would they know that you're thinking in a culturally competent way, that you're planning services and supports in a culturally competent way? Does the person at the front desk know that? And if so, what's their approach? What's their attitude? How are they conveying that in the way that they're interacting? A lot of studies are talking about that families really have documented the fact that the first point of contact that they have with organizations either makes them feel comfortable enough to even come, have received supports and services, or even just to talk to someone, that if the first point of contact, if that interaction is a little bit off, then it has all kinds of not so positive effects on what the families are thinking and perceiving and understanding about that agency, and may cause them not even to continue to seek the support. When we think about cultural competence, there's really sort of five basic ideas when we're talking about it, us as individuals and how it relates to us. So probably really the first piece of it is acknowledging that there are differences, that people have lots of similarities, but it is the differences that sometimes get us into hot water. So thinking about that, acknowledging it, and being prepared for it. Then taking a look at yourself and your own culture and what that means to you in terms of what have you learned about other groups through your cultural lens? What have you learned about yourself? And how does that impact you when you're interacting with others? And so then another piece of that is engaging in some level of self-assessment or self-reflection, of which there are a number of sort of checklists and tools that are available to really take a look at whether you are, how you are, to assess your level of cultural understanding and cultural competence. And then sort of the next feature or factor is really making sure that you're open to learning about other groups. Maybe it's patients for families, maybe it's docs, or maybe it's service providers across the board, service providers, but really taking a moment to try to learn, what is it that I don't know about this individual? What is it that I don't know about their particular background? How can I expand that? And what skills might I need to be able to work with that individual or that family or that provider? And no matter, again, whatever the attitude is or whatever the behavior is, sometimes we talk a lot about families not being compliant or not following through, or we gave them the referral and they didn't make it there. And sometimes families think like, well, I gave them that information and they're not quite following through on it, and I don't understand why they're not making the connection for me. But it's always to try to view it, whatever has happened that's on the positive or what may have happened that's on the negative, to try to understand it from that other cultural perspective or sort of from the other side of the mirror. So when we think about culture beyond the individual and looking at an institution or an organization, they're really quite similar. This whole idea of valuing diversity, doing some self-assessment, see what are your strengths, your agency strengths, what are your agency's areas for growth, and what might you do to meet any gaps. Sometimes over the course of our 15 years of being up and running at the NCCC, we've done a number of organizational assessments in a range of states. And sometimes we find out that states, departments of health, provider networks are not even always aware of the strengths of the people that are in their network. It's been really eye-opening for them. In New Mexico, actually, in an organizational assessment, there was a discovery in one health district that someone had put together a sort of compendium of terms that families from Hispanic background in that state had been using to describe different health conditions. And this was available and being used widely in that particular health district, but none of the other four were aware of it. And it was a tool that was readily available and something that once they found out through talking to each other as a result of the organizational assessment became something that was shared across the health districts, something that was a really handy tool. So, you know, taking this look inside your organization is really quite critical to help understand what your internal strengths are and the areas of growth. When we're talking about managing the dynamics of difference, that's just really recognizing that sometimes when individuals or groups from different backgrounds come together, they're not always going to see things eye to eye. And being prepared for that, again, with some skills of navigation, some skills of listening, some skills of resolving issues and concerns, but always having that in the back of your mind that to be prepared for it, just in case there are any issues or concerns or people not seeing eye to eye, how to work that through. The other sort of piece or factor for organizational cultural competence is making sure that whatever cultural knowledge about a community, about a population or a group is known, that it's not only known by one person, that everybody in the organization has this understanding of or information. Because what happens when the person who's the keeper of all this knowledge leaves? And say it's something like referrals to tribal organizations that provide support or that provide connections, linkages. And that one person that was in the agency had all these contacts, knew who's the person to go to for this, who to go to for that, and that person leaves the state, gets married, gets a different job offer that maybe has more fiscal or more money behind it. They leave. And if that information hasn't been shared, then the organization will be starting back at zero as if none of those contacts or connections had ever been made. So it's really, really important to make sure that knowledge of different groups or different communities is shared across your agency, organization, or your staff and personnel. Then the last sort of characteristics around organizational cultural competence is adapting to diversity. So what does that mean? That if you're in an area where families are working during the day and not able to make it in to take part in your services or to benefit from your services, that maybe some thought should be given to making some shifts in hours so that people can get to come in and get the benefit of your service. In some situations where transportation has been an issue because of, or maybe communities have been isolated, then people have worked out some strategies for getting transportation to get families from point A, from their home or a central location, to the service or support. So lots of sort of opportunities for creativity and being able to make some adaptations to meet the sort of needs of families, communities, and populations. And again, always to underscore that with having it in writing in a policy format and having some way to make sure that it's funded and some personnel who would be able to support the initiative or the action, making sure that it's explicit in the values and the services that people receive. So probably most critical is that cultural competence is not just for the people at the top who are the administrators or setting policy, but through every level of an organization. So maybe the people who are setting the rules or the policy, the administrators, those who oversee things, the managers who make sure things get done, the frontline folks who make sure the ones who are really on the ground working face-to-face or over the phone or however with families, as well as families being involved because they actually provide critical information, feedback, can help in thousands of ways in terms of helping you to make sure as a provider that you are actually meeting the needs or understanding the needs of individuals, families, and communities. So there is this slide that has this continuum of cultural competence. It's sort of looking at moving from the lower side of a continuum to the upper side. And the idea that no one is ever expecting anyone to ever be culturally competent or even beyond that, to be culturally proficient around every single group, ethnic, racial, gender, geographic, disability, fill in the blank. No one is ever expecting that because it's really sort of impossible. Like studies are actually showing that you can only be competent in your own culture.
Could I have somebody? Hello? But, could I have a watch?
Hello?
If I can ask you on the phone to press *6 to mute your line, because some of us can hear you. And then if you want to unmute to ask questions, it's *6. Okay, thank you.
But the idea that cultural competence sort of is on a continuum and that you may be great, you may be at the upper end of the continuum with one group or with one age, maybe you're really great with adolescents, maybe you're really great around transition issues, maybe not as great or in on another place on the continuum when it comes to working with a particular or disease-specific issue or with older family members or with people who are older who have a health condition or a special health care need that you may not be familiar with. The idea is that as long as you, again, are willing to continue to acquire knowledge and acquire skills and are moving towards the upper end of the continuum, that it's fine as long as you're making progress and as long as you're open and growing. Another construct that we have is actually around linguistic competence. And when we first came up with this definition, this is my boss, Tor Good, and myself, our definition, we were looking around for definitions of linguistic competence, and lots of them were really focusing on language in terms of phonemes and really linguistic kind of issues. Then we found a couple, maybe from a couple of federal agencies that were looking at only people who speak English as a second language. And our thought, even though we're the National Center for Cultural Competence, is that there are lots of other people who fall into the group of people who require linguistic or communication access. And so our definition really looks at an agency and its staff or personnel's ability to really communicate information in a way that's going to be meaningful and useful for individuals who are receiving it so that they can take it and really make meaningful decisions or get their needs addressed or learn more about something that is going to help them to progress and to prosper. So we look at the issue of health literacy and that as part of linguistic competence, that it's an agency or an organization and its staff sort of responsibility to recognize when families may be having some difficulty understanding information as it relates to health and take an extra effort to make sure that they are able to meet those needs or make information clear. And again, that they will always have in the visual policy to back it up, to make sure that it's stated and it's plain and it's clear. Practices, like if you have someone who comes in who requires sign interpretation or who requires services for people with who are deaf or hard of hearing, that people, front desk staff or service provider, would know how to access those services to make it available for the family that needs it. Again, that there would be some budgeted item, some line item somewhere that is earmarked specifically for interpretation, translation, whether it's sign, whether it's foreign language, for large braille prints, for whatever the need the person or family might have to be able to understand information to the greatest ability. And so for the next part of the conversation, we're going to be looking at sort of the interconnection or the interrelatedness and the why for family-centered care and culturally competent approaches. So I'm going to breathe for a second, and Trish.
Thank you. And I, if you guys have, Wendy, we're going to do questions after I finish, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you, it's a slightly different twist, looking at cultural competence, and that is looking at the family-centered care piece. And really, it follows along with a lot of what Wendy said, looking at, the overall cultural competency and weaving that in. And the concepts of family-centered care really deal with everything that we already know, but sometimes it's really hard to be consciously aware all the times of what those concepts are and reminding ourselves. And one of them is just looking at the dignity and respect and in family-centered care and honoring the families and the patients and their perspectives and their choices that they make. And to acknowledge that, you know, the patients and the families do have some knowledge. They also come with their own values and beliefs and their own cultural backgrounds. And with family-centered care, what they look at doing is really trying to infuse and incorporate all that into the planning and delivery of care. And we all know, to us as individuals, how important that would be. Say if you had, you know, a child with special health care needs, and I'm going to use being deaf, to know how to work with that person who may have that type of disability. They, in the past, what would happen would be the provider would provide all the information to the family member who could speak, and they would kind of just really leave out and almost ignore the person who was deaf. And now they're looking at really incorporating that person and making sure that they have, you know, the information about, you know, their treatment and care. And a lot of times, because I do have a son who is deaf, and he's had a progressive loss over the years, I let him know that you know, the questions really need to be addressed to him. And if they cannot either write it down in language that's not, you know, at a professional level, and to use terminology that he can understand, so that he actually knows in the beginning what is happening to him regarding the health care delivery that he's going to receive from whatever healthcare specialist that is there. It was very important to him as well as to us, because he also speaks, and his speech is probably 85% understandable by the general public. So when he started speaking, people made the assumption that he could hear them. And so instead of, you know, them facing directly looking at him, he would not be able to read your lips or to understand anything that you were saying if you were turned to the side. And a lot of the times the doctor, you know, or specialist would turn to the side and start flipping through the chart and be talking at the same time. And that really was not working because he was not getting half of anything they were saying at all. And so it really, you know, he would go in and give them information and tell them, this is how you work with me. You know, I am deaf. I do speak. But if you're not facing me directly, I am not hearing or understanding really any of the information that you'll be telling me. Please continue to look at me and speak. And if I have a question, you know, I'm going to put my hand out for you to stop. And, you know, I will write, I will write down or point to, if you have the chart in front of me, when they would sometimes draw pictures for him, which he really liked. But I think, you know, basically that is just really looking at honoring their dignity and respect and pulling in and learning about their cultural backgrounds. And right now, with our changing healthcare system, it is so important that we share our information. And that we, as, you know, looking at the healthcare practitioners, they really need to communicate and share their complete and unbiased information with the with the patients and the families in ways that they are affirming and useful to them. And they really need to receive that information in a timely, complete, and accurate way so that they can either react or get back to them if they need to do so. Again, trying to be reciprocal in that way in the information sharing. Because right now, with the changing healthcare system, it's particularly hard for, it's hard for everyone, but working with the tribal nations across the country because of sovereignty and the owning of information belongs to each individual tribe, and most of the tribes receive their health care through either a 638 program, which means the tribe is running their own health care program, or through the Indian Health Service. And the Indian Health Service, it's really hard to get information out of them, again, because the information belongs to the tribe. And so they're looking at, you know, educating families so that they're taking, you know, hard copies right now of their information so that they can help in expediting whatever the service may be at the time so that they have the information. And right now, because we've gone to the electronic records, a lot of our families don't think that they can ask for a hard copy anymore. And so we need to start letting them know that they can still start, continue to ask for a hard copy and keep that information sharing going back and forth. And I think ongoing, we really need to continue engaging and encouraging their participation in their care and decision making at whatever level they feel comfortable at. The patient themselves may not feel comfortable, especially if it's a child, not understanding what the services might be. And so I think, you know, then the parents can be involved and take over and start, you know, making some of those decisions, but also sharing with their child, you know, what is going to happen. And so that there's, you know, an ongoing, again, just looking at that dignity and respecting, trying to be consciously aware of pulling that in. The other piece is really looking at, you know, the collaboration and collaboration between all who are involved. A lot of times I think assumptions are made that, you know, there's a great information flow, and in essence, that is really not happening. So that's why we encourage the, you know, it's so important to encourage the families to get the information in hard copy so that the information on the paper belongs to the family. The paper may belong to the agency, that they obtained it from, but the information is the families. And I think that's an important concept that we need to tell our families, because, again, they feel sometimes, especially families who have migrated to this country, who have come from areas that, where they were oppressed. And so to ask for information or to even share information, sometimes they feel like, they do not, they don't think they can do that. So sometimes, it's reminding them that they can do that and to share the information, because they just don't do that sometimes. And again, it's so important to have, that collaboration between all the parties involved and those families, and looking at pulling in, youth also, because they're our next generation and they really need to start looking at, being at those decision-making tables and making sure that they're included as a part of this overall family-centered care, and looking at the cultural competency, on a broad spectrum. Families know best. A lot of information, as an example, I just went to a meeting a couple of days ago, and they were asking about, the surveys and evaluations were done, and they got a very poor response. Two teams went out and did the same evaluation. One got a great responses from the families. They got, they got a very high number of families participating, and the other group, had minimal participation with not all the information filled out on the evaluations that they put out. And when they pulled together and really looked at it, it was because with the other organization, they had, community input. They had family input. They had youth input regarding where the evaluations might be taking place, how those evaluations might, the information might be obtained, and who was going to be obtaining and asking those questions. The other group did not. So again, it just, showing the importance of having that ongoing partnership and collaboration across the board. And it's something that we know that, it's very simple in doing that, but because there's so many other things happening, that sometimes we need to just take a step back and really look at slowing down and seeing, because we can, if we really look at the broad picture, I think sometimes it becomes more clear to us what needs to be done. And having the community engagement at whatever level, I think is very important, because it's them. But they cannot do it. We cannot move forward and infuse family-centered care or cultural and linguistic competence if we don't have people working toward that. And again, as Wendy had mentioned, it's really meeting people at their level and being interested enough just to know that that is important, that's an important component of providing services. And what our families have been telling us is that when that happens, when they're involved, and when the partners providing the services take the time to really acknowledge them it could be merely just saying, we're so glad you made it here to clinic today. The weather may be bad, and just taking that time to do that tiny little showing respect and dignity to them that they actually were able to make it. Because we don't know what their day was like. And it's looking, trying to, again, focus on the positive. The majority of the time, focusing on the positive first, and then looking back at where there needs to be areas of improvement. Whether it's, you know, the information sharing, if the families, are not aware of what types of information that they need in order to expedite various services within their circle of providers. It's families tell us, you know what, that we need to be reminded just as the service providers do. And families are always telling us I was never asked. They never asked me at all, and I was waiting that entire time to ask. And when families go back, because sometimes they're very overwhelmed, it's asking them again. They want to be asked again. They want, again, to be assured. That's just building that relationship. Because sometimes this may be the first time some families may have been asked for their input. And they're not sure. They're not trusting enough to really think that you meant what you said. So it's important to ask again and to ask again, because it makes a difference. And they do tell us that, you know, when we're asked, we feel valued, and we're willing to help wherever we can and support them. When they need us, we're willing, you know, to go to bat for them. And so I think, let me see. Deneen, I wasn't sure if we were going to go only an hour.
We can go as long as you need to, Trish.
Okay. Well, I hate to keep anybody from supper and everything else. But I think, again, you know, it's really looking very holistically at how we do things, when we do things, the how, what, when, and where, and why. Those are very simple things that are always out there, but sometimes we forget to ask ourselves those questions. And I think, as Wendy had mentioned, looking at, you know, that piece, that comes in looking at the how, what, when, where, and why. Because we all answer that very differently, because of our differences. But sometimes they may be very similar. And I think looking at really building on those similarities, but also being able to acknowledge what those differences are. And just, you know, when I go out and meet people for the first time, I always try and let them know that because I'm not familiar with them or their community, to please let, you know, there may be terminology that I may use that may be not understood or maybe even inappropriate, for them to please know that, you know, my intentions were not to offend anybody, and to please correct me at the time and let me know what is proper, because if we don't share with one another how we want to be acknowledged or worked with, then we're part of the barrier. We need to move forward and let them know. And when I've said that before, and I've seen other colleagues across that we've worked with kind of do that disclaimer, that kind of just sets a whole different tone. You know, it's just like, you know, people were all tense, and then all of a sudden, you know, they let go of that, and it just kind of opens it up to have a more positive atmosphere when information sharing is happening. I also have to let you know I'm doing this from home, and I have my tiny little grandson just walked into the room, and he's singing. I'm going to have to.
Matt, can you wait for them outside? I'm busy. I'll be on a call, okay?
I'm sorry. He comes in and shares the songs he learned at school with me. So with that, Wendy, is there anything you would like to add?
No, just that we are open to your questions, comments, or suggestions or concerns.
Great job, ladies. Does anybody have any questions? If you're on mute, you can press it's #6 to put it on mute, *6 to put unmute yourself. So, or if you have any comments at all for Wendy or Trish.
I have a question. I'm not sure who it would be directed to, but do you know where you could go to find more information for, like, individuals for LEP, the limited English proficient, any guidelines?
You can go to LEP.gov.
Okay.
It's a website that has lots of information, and this now, it depends upon the language. There is information on LEP.gov in Spanish, and there are regulations. There are some links to other sites that have translated information to support individuals with limited English proficiency. There's even information around the law, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Section 601, that's in multiple languages to help people who have limited English proficiency, to help them understand what their rights are and what they should expect from agencies and organizations.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else?
Can you name a few of the cultural assessment tools that seem to be the best?
The best. That's interesting. I'm not going to put any quantifiers, but I will say that it depends on what you were looking to do. If you want to do some self-assessment, some self-reflection activities, I can send you to the NCC's website. If you just Google National Center for Cultural Competence and look under Tools and Resources, and then under search by type, there are a number of checklists to answer a lot of different, or for different people in different disciplines to use. There's one for people who are working with families of young children in early intervention or early education settings. There's one for families of children with special health care needs or disability. There's another one for families who are with children with emotional or behavioral disability. There's one for families who've experienced a loss of a child or a sudden infant death. And I'm now, because I named all of those, I'm going to forget what the others are. But there are actually 6 such checklists. If you're seeking to do more, if you're a healthcare provider or a healthcare practitioner, there's a tool called the Cultural Competence Health Practitioner Assessment, or CCHPA, that also is available online. It's an individual assessment that does not give scores. It has 6 domains. You think of a particular ethnic, cultural, racial, social, and geographic group in mind. Have one, not all of those, but just one, that you're thinking of as you take it. And what it does is give you resources, tools, videos, articles, materials to help you move to the next level. It doesn't tell you you got a 4.5 and what that means, but it does give you the upper option to check out some materials to help you move forward. There's also, if you're looking to do an organizational assessment, there's something called the CLCPA, Cultural and Linguistic Competence Practitioners Assessment, Policy Assessment, that is also available on the website.
Thank you very much.
They also have a really good one for doing an individual assessment, and I think it's really important that, you know, everyone do that periodically, because, again, things change. Life is ongoing, fluid, and always changing. So what was true. And what comes to mind is the iceberg Wendy talked about, and how some of those things might, you know, seeing the stuff on the top of the iceberg, some of those things might change. And so it's really important that, you know, we look to see where we're at regarding our cultural and linguistic competence. And they have a great one on there, and that can also be found on NCC's website.
So also, here's another shameless plug. It's not an assessment, but there is something that's called a curricular enhancement module series on our website as well. And what it is that for another one of our funders, another maternal and child health funder, but this funder really focuses on building the skills and capacity of future leaders in maternal and child health, so then the future providers across the spectrum of providers who would be working with families and youth and children. And so what were developed were four different modules that all give you some basic content around cultural and linguistic competence, values, guiding principles, definitions, and some terms and concepts. But each module is different in the theme that it touches, and there are some self-reflection activities, which are another way of doing a self-assessment or a self-monitoring your own values and beliefs and practices and how that impacts or affects your interactions with others. There's also some vignettes and some stories and some things to help you sort of read a scenario and work it through and answer some questions. No right or wrong answers, but they're all there just really to increase awareness, knowledge, and to offer some information to help you improve your skill.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else have any questions for Wendy and Trish? Do we have a quiet bunch?
Could you talk about the difference
between
diversity and cultural competency? I know some people interchange those, but...
Well, for our purposes, diversity is really mentioning the fact that there are differences, and that those differences do... they sort of come down to differences in thoughts, differences in behavior, differences in actions. But that's about as far as diversity goes. What it doesn't sort of have contained in its concept or construct is the idea of having some skills to try to meet it. So, yes, we do have differences. We do have similarities. But what do you need to do, or how do you work towards managing those differences or that diversity? And that's basically what culturally competent values, practices, beliefs do, is give you some set of understandings of how to move forward and some sets of skills to help you to actually put it into practice and hopefully make meaningful connections and relationships with families.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody want to provide any feedback to Wendy and Trish at all on whether you've now got a better understanding of cultural competence and what it entails and how to begin? Does anybody want to talk about that or have any other questions? None.
Well, this isn't a question, but I wanted to commend Deneen on really her efforts in reaching out to the tribal nations in North Dakota, because North and South Dakota are two of the states that it's very difficult for to do that. Tribes up there are very hesitant about who opening up their communities. And Deneen, I hear good things you know, from the tribal nations in North Dakota that she's, you know, doing good things and trying to keep, you know, them involved in the information sharing. So Denise and I wanted to say that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Anybody have any last minute questions before Trish and Wendy leave? Is Janet Green on the phone by chance? There will be a learning collaborative coming in January on cultural competence. So if any of you that are on the phone have an interest to be a part of that learning collaborative, where you will come and we'll strategize about children with special health care needs and a learning collaborative for what may be needed through cultural competence, please send me an email and I will get it to the people that need to have that information. So if you're interested, I believe it's January 21st or 22nd. So do let me know because we'll be grateful to have anybody come and attend. That would be wonderful and want to participate. So with that being said, Wendy and Trish, thank you so very, very much for joining us this evening. And I hope everybody has a very Merry Christmas. And Wendy, I hope you get a little bit of rest after your big trip.
Thank you. Same to you and everyone else.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Trish.
Care. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now...